50 States of Terror may include content unsuitable for young audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Content warnings will be included in the show notes.
I was once a mighty beast, ruler of the land and of the sea.
Hello, world. Your favorite podcast host about cryptids, Anthony Diaz here. Man, what can I say? This episode was super fun, and I am so glad I had Tony D reach out and want to be a part of the show. This is almost a little over a month, I think, in the making. He reached out in early September. I had already done the Q&A episode. He was doing a book tour at signing, so we scheduled this. We did the damn thing. we had the interview, and it was so much fun. This whole episode will be put on regular podcasts, and then the video will be on YouTube. Of course, Patreon gets it first. So, and almost forgot, the band Joel hit me up as well and wanted to see if I wanted to maybe put a sample or some of their music on the show, and I said hell yes. So the intro music that you already heard and going to hear again at the end of the episode is "I Am the Loch Ness Monster" by Joel, and it's a jam, man. I love it, and this is great. It was a wonderful month for people who wanted to be a part of the show, and I can't thank y'all enough. I'll put all the socials out there. And man, I don't know what to say. I'm just so happy that all this came about. And yeah, so enjoy the episode. And yeah, later, y'all. Oh, there we go. Recording. All right, we're good. it's an awesome how whenever you're doing stuff for the first time and everything just seems to go great beforehand, and then when you start recording, it just goes to shit.
Right. Right. That's why I wanted to check my microphone. The first couple of times I did these things, it just goes to hell.
Oh, man. Tony, DiGerolamo, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I truly, truly appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is actually one of the first times that someone actually reached out to the show and wanted to talk about cryptids and wanted to talk about, you know, things that I put on the show. And I want to just go right into it and dive straight into the topic, which is the Jersey
Let's
Devil.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. I want to know, I did research a little bit on you, and you're from New Jersey, correct?
Yes. Yes. I lived in South Jersey most of my life.
When was the first time that you ever heard, about the Jersey Devil?
I was in, probably middle school, and I had to do a book report, and I went into the library and I was looking for the shortest book in the library. Across the room, I saw this little red spine. And I grabbed the book, and it was a book on the Jersey Devil.
And that was your very first time hearing about it. You didn't hear like any like playground stories or any ghost stories as a kid from parents or anything like that?
Probably the first time I heard about it was in grammar school when I was a kid. We used to watch the film about the Jersey Devil. It was called Mother Leeds 13th Child.
Oh,
and they
okay.
would show it to all the school kids. And it was made in 1974. You could probably find it on YouTube somewhere. And it was just a dramatization about Mother Leeds and then some of the later sightings that took place in the Pine Barrens.
Have you been there? Have you actually been to the area where the legend
comes
from?
Oh, yeah, I'm there all the time.
Really?
I was there, let's see, where did I go? I went to Tom's River, so I had to drive through the pines to get there. I called my brother on the way home because I was like an hour out and I was bored. Yeah, I'm usually there every week. My parents live in Blue Anchor, which is next to Hamilton, which is blueberry capital of the world, and it's right basically in the pines. I mean, it's the Pine Barrens, it's a little difficult. I mean, you people who are more stringent will say, oh, it's the Wharton State Forest, and it's the State Forest, and just that's the Pine Barrens.
Right.
But really, the lower half of the state was all Pine Barrens at one point. So.
Because that's the National Reserve, right? The whole forest area, that's protected land?
Yeah, a lot of it is.
Yeah.
But it's New Jersey, so they play fast and loose with the rules here. And every once in a while, the Pine Lands Commission will stop enforcing rules and someone will build a gas station. And like, how did this get here? And then other times, like, actually, my folks were going to build a house in Blue Anchor. And they had a plot of land, but the Pine Lands Commission wouldn't let them build because they were going through a phase, oh, you can't build anything. It's a pine barrens. And then they couldn't build it, and eventually they had to sell the land, and we never moved down there. So,
oh wow,
it's weird. It's weird.
Like I said, what are you drinking? Do you some tea or?
I'm drinking iced tea, which nice. Is what I always drink.
I'm drinking a nice iced coffee. My like I said in the show, my experience in New Jersey was Hoboken.
I'm so sorry. Okay.
It wasn't too. I was a kid, and this is when my dad was stationed in Quantico, Virginia. He was a 27-year Marine Corps, so he retired after 27 years, and I joined in 04. And every once in a while, we would go drive up to Baltimore area in Washington D.C., and we had a friend of ours. Well, not me personally, but them, a family friend who lived in Hoboken. That was my very first experience in New Jersey. And I don't remember a whole lot going into Hoboken, but I do remember like what, if you were to close your eyes and think, okay, what would Hoboken look like? And then I imagine like this old school type, old timey, downtown area with brick buildings and hard to find streets with back alleys and a bunch of like people outside and in front of grocery stores or this is like 7-year-old me thinking about it. And I went over there and it was green. It was nice. it was pretty cool. And then going up to New York for the very first time. Yeah. So New Jersey, the only thing I remember is Hoboken. I don't remember the drive, but I do want to go back to New Jersey because I've seen pictures and doing research on the Jersey Devil. I've seen the pines. I've seen pictures of them. I never watched shows like the Jersey Shore, and I never planned to. But I usually, when I talk to people from New Jersey, they don't like, nah, don't worry about that. Just visit the nice places in New Jersey. Just visit the better places.
Exactly. New Jersey is kind of like a small version of the United States. And we have just about every kind of geography except for desert and tundra. So we have mountains up in the top of the state. And then we have a very industrial park closer to New York and closer to Philly. And then as you come further south, it gets more and more rural until you get to farm areas and then you get to Wharton State Forest. And then eventually you get to Cape May, which is this little Victorian town with B&Bs. And it's a beautiful place with the Jersey Shore. And it's just beautiful. So like everybody thinks of New Jersey as the Sopranos, like opening up Sopranos. And that's the way it is up near Elizabeth and closer to New York and Jersey City. But yeah, it's a small part of the state. Most of it is pretty woodsy, I would say. Lots of roads, though. So even in the Pine Barrens, if you get lost, if you walk an hour in one direction, you'll hit a road.
When you first heard of the Jersey Devil, was there a beginning fascination with things like cryptids besides Jersey Devil, like maybe Sasquatch or the Mothman, things like that?
No, I was more into the folklore and the history of the Jersey Devil because to me, Bigfoot and the other cryptids didn't have the historical sort of bent that the Jersey Devil did. The Jersey Devil has a real connection to actual people who are, you know, you can look up. You know, the Leeds family actually existed in New Jersey.
Yeah, that was a very fascinating thing when I was doing the research. This is probably one of the first ones that I've done in the complete history of the show where you're right. There is a pinpoint historical person that you can draw this back to and read up on if you want to. Like, most of them come from the indigenous people's stories or European stories. Like, I did one on giants. But yeah, this is by far one of the first ones, and one of my top five actually, because the lore is just so fantastic. It's just palpable of how much stuff you can get into and deep dive into it. I love it.
And when you sort of look at it and then look at history after it, you start to realize interesting things about it. So, for instance, the most basic tale of the Jersey Devil is that Mother Leeds, the mother of the Jersey Devil, was the 13th child in her family, mm-hmm. and she had 13 children, and the last one was born the Jersey Devil. So this is 288 years old. This could be where unlucky 13 comes from, right? Most people say, oh, 13, we don't want a 13th floor in our hotel. That's unlucky.
All right.
I don't like 13. It's unlucky. Or, you know, a goth girl. Oh, I love 13. it could be the very first time that this was a thing, because when you look at some of the other cryptids and some of the other folk tales and how they emerge, you realize that the Jersey Devil could have been sort of the default that they based the other legends from.
Right.
You know? They used it as an infrastructure to kind of go, okay, well, the Gator Man is here, and he lives in the woods, and he was born on a stormy night. Like, it's all kind of the basic concepts that the Jersey Devil sort of started with. And there's so many variations on the Jersey Devil legend down here. You can read about it in that red book written by McCloy and Miller called The Jersey Devil.
Okay.
And they did quite a bunch of research. I met Miller years ago.
Really?
Yeah, and I asked him, is there any, you know, how much historical, you know, stuff is there about the actual birth? And what he said was there was a branch of the Leeds family, Deborah and Japhet Leeds. They lived on Moss Mill Road in Leeds Point, New Jersey, where the Jersey Devil was born. Mm-hmm. This is across from Smithville, New Jersey, a place South Jersey people will know where it is. And in their family Bible, they had listed 12 children, and this is what you did in the 1700s. You would list your family in the family Bible, mm-hmm. and then they had a 13th space that was blank. So the blank space could have been they never had a 13th child. They did have a 13th child, but it died, and they never named it. But their theory is they did have a 13th child, but it was severely handicapped. And in the 1700s, they would have said, what is wrong with this child? Well, he's touched by the devil.
Yeah.
And the family might have said, well, we can't write his name in the Bible. That would be blasphemous. We can't take him out of the house. It's a scandal. So they would have kept him in the house. The Leeds had money and influence. They would have had servants. The servants would have seen him. And then you get whispered down the lane, you might get part of the legend.
I want to touch on that real quick. Were the Leeds family rich? Were they a well-to-do family in the area? They were?
Yes. So because Daniel Leeds in the 1700s was the patriarch, and New Jersey was divided. It was a province. It wasn't a state. It was the province of West and East Jersey.
Right.
The line went somewhere north of Trenton and down the diagonally in the state. Above the line was East Jersey. Below the line was West Jersey. These days we would call it North Jersey and South Jersey. Or as the locals say, Taylor ham and pork roll.
Because okay.
That's our battle. We argue over Taylor ham and pork roll. Leeds was a representative of the king. So you had to go to the Leeds because you needed permission from the king to open a business, to farm land, because it all belonged to the king.
This is during the time of King Charles II, correct?
This would have been, I mean, it would have been King George.
King George? III.
And who was right before? Was that this Charles II or George?
I believe II? So, because that's when it was like Lord Berkeley and Lord Charolette, right? When the separation between two lines.
I'm not sure who was before, right before George, but it's I think in 1730 it might have been George II. So Daniel Leeds was this patriarch. He was very powerful. He eventually died, and his son Titan became the new patriarch. And during that time, they published the Leeds Family Almanac, which was very popular. But one of our founding fathers, right around that time, was publishing his own almanac. And he was trying to smear the Leeds so he could sell more almanacs.
Oh,
you know, you know which one I'm referring to, which founding father?
I off the top of my head, I would probably have to say George Washington.
Ben Franklin? Mm-hmm. He was a young printer in the 1730s. And so he was publishing Poor Richard's Almanac, which was new. So he would publish things in his almanac, smearing the Leeds. And at that time, the Leeds had a falling out with the Quakers, who were big players in pre-colonial America. And so he was kind of piling on because he knew it was good for business. And so he would say stuff like, well, you could read the Leeds Family Almanac, but that has astrology in it. That sounds like witchcraft to me.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, they had a family crest on the Leeds Family Almanac. It looks like a little dragon if you look it up. And that sort of looks like a prototype of the Jersey Devil. So he was just smearing them all day long. He even predicted that Titan Leeds would die on a specific date and year. And then when Titan didn't die, they said, Franklin, he's not dead. And Franklin went, oh, he's dead. His ghost is writing the almanac. And that's why you shouldn't read it. And you should buy Poor Richard's Almanac.
Oh, wow.
So he was just relentless. And that would have fed into the legend, along with just the general resentment people would have had for the people who had all the power in the region. You know, everybody was a farmer or tavern owner or whatever. So you would have been eking out a living, and you would have, you know, if you had gotten, say, a plot of land from the Leeds in the Pine Barrens, you might get there and start farming and realize nothing's really growing here except pine cones.
Oh.
And that could be pretty devastating. You spent all that money and time, and now you can't feed your family. You might start resenting the Leeds. So you may have had this actual child being born. You had Franklin smearing people, and you just had people talking all day long about, you know, people just... When I go out and do a talk about the Jersey Devil, I'll go to a bar or whatever, and I'll do my talk. And I often say, you know, in the 1700s, this is what people did. A big loudmouth like me would get up in front of people and start telling stories and, you know, whisper down the lane, you get the Jersey Devil. Although back then, they would have called it the Leeds Devil. They didn't call it the Jersey Devil then. They called it the Leeds Devil up until about 1909.
Right, right. Do you think the whole entire history of the Jersey Devil is still shapes how the community functions on a day-to-day basis
in South Jersey?
In South Jersey, yeah.
Well, yeah, to some extent, because we have so many Jersey Devil related things down here. Now, we have a hockey team, but that's really a North Jersey thing, but
yeah.
You know, we're very protective of it because they tried to move the team to Nashville, and we were like, you can't move the team to Nashville. It's the Jersey Devil.
It's the Jersey Devil.
So they didn't, fortunately. It is New Jersey's official state demon. If you go to the government's website, you will see it listed there. We're the only state with an official state demon.
That is fascinating.
We have Jersey Devil chocolate, Jersey Devil beer, Jersey Devil wine. There's Jersey Devil Jeep, Jersey Devil Tattoo, the Jersey Devil Roller Coaster, a Great Adventure. We have Jersey Devil Marina, Jersey Devil Mini Golf. I mean, everybody, there was Jersey Devil Dogs, which was a hot dog stand. It's closed now. Anything South Jersey, a lot of people will name it after Jersey Devil. You can go to Lucille's Luncheonette. They had a big giant statue of the Jersey Devil. It got stolen recently, and they
replaced
it now. Yeah, some guy from Ohio tied his truck to it and pulled the statue down and tried to leave with it.
Oh, that's horrible.
But and they sell a Jersey Devil cheesesteak. Then you have the statues that are in Smithville at one of the bars there. You have JD's Pub, which has a Jersey Devil logo, and that's not far from Smithville. You have Leeds Point, which really doesn't exploit the Jersey Devil legend as much as you think they would, but everybody talks about it. So if you go to the Oyster Creek restaurant, which is in Leeds Point, and pretty much the closest place you could be to where the Jersey Devil and Leeds Point would have been back in the 1700s, almost everybody says, oh, the Jersey Devil was born here in the parking lot, or there's a shed just in the woods, and that's where it was born. And every 20 years or so, somebody will find a shed out in the woods and say, ah, this was where the Jersey Devil was born. And they'll tear a piece off and say, I got a piece of the Jersey Devil. And over 20 years, they'll pull it to pieces and then it'll disappear. And then somebody will pick another shed and say, look, it's where the Jersey Devil was born.
Do you think people exploit the fact that Jersey Devil is so popular to bring people in tourism out? Because I did one episode of the Shunkawarrican, and if you don't know what the Shunkawarrican is, it's a large hyena, and it's a descendant of a large hyena. And there was a hunter, maybe about, I think in the early 1900s, I think in the 1900s, if memory serves me correctly, and they said that they shot it, and they mounted it, and they did a taxidermy on it, and was traveling, doing a road show, presenting the Shunkawarrican. And it turned out that the one that they have was this this hybrid of a dog, wolf, hyena looking thing, but it was stolen maybe about 10 years after it got done with the tour, and then wanted a huge reward for it. But then come to find out, it was never really stolen; it was just hidden somewhere, and just wanted money to come in. Is that common for something that's popular as Jersey Devil in South Jersey?
Not at all, because the one tourist trap that could take advantage of the Jersey Devil, I shouldn't call it a tourist trap, but it's a tourist area. Smithville, the historic Smithville, is the closest thing. Leeds Point, there's almost nothing there. I mean, there's houses. Yeah, there's houses. The Oyster Creek restaurant is there. And there's a plaza, Leeds Point Plaza, which has a pizza joint and like a couple of stores. But there's almost nothing there. But Smithville is like a tourist, historic Smithville is a tourist thing. So it has the historic Smithville Inn, which is the original inn from 1787. And then it has buildings from about, they took every historic building from about a 50-mile radius and moved it to Smithville.
Wow, really?
Yeah, this is about 50 years ago, in order to preserve them. And then they took all those buildings and they turned them into stores. So if you go to Smithville, it's just a bunch of historic buildings that are full of shops, and you go and you shop and you eat, you know, go to the restaurants, and there's B&Bs and stuff.
Right.
And I do events there. So I tell them, and there's this really nice couple that owns the town. And I said, you should do a Jersey Devil tour on a bus with a guy in a suit, Jersey Devil suit, and sell, you know, they sell Jersey Devil stuff there. But I suggested the tour, and I said you could do the tour and have a bus and have people come back. And they were like, no. And I said, why? And they said, we don't want more drunken college students running around the woods looking for the Jersey Devil. And oh, it's a problem, because everybody comes to Leeds Point looking for the Jersey Devil, and they run around the woods, and again they find old sheds and say, oh, this is, must be where the Jersey Devil was born, and then they take it apart, and the locals get mad. So, but there is a lot of historic stuff in the woods. I mean, there are property markers from like the 1700s in the woods.
Yeah, I would think that there is a whole lot of underground history there, from especially from the Revolutionary War, the Civil War era. I would just imagine there's just a bunch of stuff that got buried over the years that has huge historical significance.
And also too, it's very swampy because it's like right on the coast, basically. So some of the towns or buildings, they're probably underwater or under the swamp or under the river. And, you know, during the Revolutionary War, the British would come in to South Jersey, and what the, they burned down the villages because they wanted to stop the bog iron industry, because we were making the cannonballs for the revolution.
Right.
And there's only one town left from that era that's been preserved. It's Batstow. But there were other towns that were burned to the ground or they're no longer around. And so if you're walking out in the pines and you find a square-shaped hole with bricks on the side of it, it's probably the root cellar of some poor guy's house that got burned down during the Revolutionary War.
Man, that's amazing. That's amazing. You know, my wife makes fun of me because I do believe in things like that there's a devil in Sasquatch. would you consider yourself a firm, like, yeah, this thing has some type of realism to it? It's not something somebody just made up. Like, what are your thoughts on the Jersey Devil?
It's a great folk tale, and it's one that has endured for almost 300 years because it just keeps changing over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the legend wasn't what it was, you know, back in the day, back in the 1700s, it was just literally people just telling the story over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And we have more modern stories, folk tales here in South Jersey. So we have one called the Echo Ghost. And the Echo Ghost is basically a kid got a ball at Christmas, it rolled out to the street, he ran to get it, and he got hit by a car, and now he haunts the road.
Oh, okay.
And you go to the road, and you flash your headlights a certain way, and walk around the car, and he appears with the ball, and he scares you, and you freak out and run away.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the basic story. But I was at a show talking about the legends and Jersey Devil and stuff, and a guy told me the Echo Ghost story, except he said it in colonial times. And it was the same exact story, except it was a little girl, and she was run over by a horse and buggy.
Okay.
But it was the same exact story. I said, that sounds like the Echo Ghost. He's like, no, no, no. It's not the Echo Ghost. It's this ghost.
It's different. Like, it's different.
So, and I've met tons of people who have seen the Jersey Devil, and they all have different descriptions. They all have different stories. One woman, a librarian, told me, she was driving down Route 206, which goes through the pines,
mm-hmm.
and she saw something on the side of the road. It looked like it had been hit by a car, and she stopped and got out of the car, and she said she could see legs and wings and feathers, and she thought it was the Jersey Devil that had been hit by a car.
Oh, wow. And
then she got freaked out, got in the car, and drove away. Didn't take a picture, of course, or anything. So,
of course, the picture would have been shaky and low pixelated, so you can't
right.
really
right, or half tree in her thumb. Another guy said, I saw the Jersey Devil. I said, what did he look like? He said, he's 8 feet tall, he's covered in head to toe with white fur, and he was sitting on somebody's lawn. And I said, well, that sounds like a Yeti. And he's like, nope, it was the Jersey Devil. And he was very sure. Another guy said, I got out of the car to go pick corn, which a lot of people do in South Jersey. We have cornfields, and during the summer months, sometimes people will just stop their car and sneak into a farmer's field and get like half a dozen. So he says, I stopped, I went into the field, and I pulled the corn apart, and there he was right in front of me, and then he took off. And he said, I was so freaked out, I jumped in the car and drove away because I was afraid, and I'll never forget it. And he was absolutely 100% convinced he saw the Jersey Devil.
Are you involved at all with the cryptozoology community and investigators or researchers primarily for the Jersey Devil?
I run into them every once in a while. There are a lot of ghost chasers in South Jersey.
Yeah, I would imagine there's a whole lot of ghost chasers. Same thing in South Texas. There's a bunch of ghost chasers here, especially with the old churches and the old from the Spanish American War. There's a bunch of places they say is haunted. But when you're talking with these researchers, do you find yourself like in the back of your mind thinking that, well, maybe I could, you know, join on a research or join on an investigation, or are you just like that person to say, look, I can tell you what I know because I live here, I'm from here, I know a lot about the history, and then just like, hey, you have fun and go enjoy your investigation?
I'm more of like, go have fun. I mean, I've run into a lot of them as I do my talks. Sometimes I do talks and then the ghost chasers will show up and they'll do a talk too.
Yeah.
But what I found is most of them are just hobbyists. They buy a lot of electronic equipment that they don't quite know how to work. And so
like those $5,000 game cameras.
Yeah. Yeah. I made fun of them in book 12 of the Pineys because it's called The Pineys and the Ghost Chasers of Ong's Hat. And the part of the premise of the story is the characters live in a town called Abe's Hat, New Jersey. And in the previous book, there was a video of one of the characters hunting a devil. But it went viral online, but nobody really saw the devil, and they mistook it for ghost chasing. Oh. So the ghost chasers are having an event in Atlantic City, and they decide to come to Abe's Hat to meet the one character who they nicknamed the Redneck. And they want to interview him to see how he can ghost chase, like how he does it. And so the running gag in the book is none of the ghost chasers know really how to operate their own equipment.
Oh, so man. That's a fantastic segue. I want to shift gears and talk about your books and about your comics. I am fascinated about your series now. I did research on the first book and I was like, this is something that's right up my alley. How long have you been writing? I did see on your IMDb page that like you've been doing this for quite a while. But like when did you first find your love for writing? Because I myself really wanted to be a writer, and I have another show called Narrative Quest where I bring on writers, artists, and talk about the creative process and how you get to that creative process, how you develop a narrative. What was that point in your life where you said, I want to do this, I want to be a writer?
So when I was in first grade, they had a contest, a short story contest for the kids. And so I entered and I won, and I kept winning every month until the school asked me to stop entering so one of the other kids could win.
That's awesome.
And I wrote my first franchise series. It was called The Inspector, and it was basically, I was a big fan of Peter Sellers, the original Inspector Clouseau. Mm-hmm. So I was basically writing short stories about this American inspector who was very clumsy but would somehow solve mysteries.
Do you like doing comedy or horror, or like what type of genre do you prefer doing? Script writing, authorship for novels, like what's your thing that you're like, yes, this is what I like to do?
Well, initially I started when I was a kid writing short stories, and then I wanted to be in movies, so I tried to write screenplays at first, but I didn't know how to do it. I didn't understand the format or anything, so I would just write like long descriptions of what I thought the movie would look like and instructions on how to shoot it. And so I would write just pages after pages of, right. It essentially was fan fiction at the time. This is when I'm like 13, 14.
Uh-huh.
And, eventually I got a book at some point that told me, oh, you got to format it this way, and this is how you format a screenplay. And then, when I went to college, I took, communications in screenwriting and script writing, and, got into the format. And that's essentially what screenwriting is. It's all format. There is some story to it, but basically you're writing the blueprint for the movie,
mm-hmm.
that the director and producer will probably ignore. So you write it as best you can, and then everybody screws it up. And that's even William Goldman, my the saint of screenwriters, said that screenwriting is like the most thankless business you'll ever be in. Everybody, you know, nobody respects you. And it's true. I mean, nobody respects a screenwriter, with the possible exception of Clint Eastwood and a handful of other filmmakers.
Uh-huh.
Most of them just go, oh, you got the screenplay? Ah, yeah, we're going to change it all. And, you know, I was on the set of a movie that they were shooting that I had written the screenplay for multiple times. And they were actually discussing the ending of the movie. And I was like, why are you discussing the ending of the movie? I wrote the ending of the movie. Just shoot the ending of the movie. And one of the producers actually pitched to me the ending for Nightmare on Elm Street. And I went, I know that ending. That's the ending of Nightmare on Elm Street. He's like, yeah, but nobody remembers that. I go, nobody remembers it. Are you an idiot? I said, you can't shoot that. I said, I don't want my name on this movie if you shoot that. And thankfully, they didn't shoot it, although the movie itself was like, meh. So, you know, this is the, unfortunately, the lack of respect in the movie industry. But everybody in the movie industry will complain, ah, there's no good writers. I don't know why there's no good writers. Yeah, you don't pay them, you don't respect them, and you don't listen to them. So, gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the Pineys.
But after that...
Oh, no, please go ahead. Please go ahead.
Eventually, I got back in the book. Oh, sorry. After that, I got in the comics because I said... somebody had said to me, I think it was Brian Polito of Chaos Comics, said, comic books are a poor man's film medium. And I said, oh, I'm poor. And so I started writing comics. And it turned out to be a good way to kind of write your movie and show people, well, this is the movie I want to do. And so that's initially how I got into it. Unfortunately, it's really tough to make money in comics, especially if you're not an artist, and I'm not. So over the years, I struggled to push the comics. I had some success here and there, but overall, it's not really a good money maker anymore. I never broke into the mainstream. And at this point, I couldn't possibly do it because of the way, and I won't go into comics. If you want to do a 7-hour podcast about the state of the comic book industry, I'll be happy to join you. but it's a complete wreck now. So recently I discovered Amazon was doing these serialized fiction novels, these novellas.
Yeah.
And I looked at the price point and saw how easy it was. I said, ooh, maybe I'll do it this way. And I started writing the books, and now I don't need artists except for my cover guy, Vig Starmax, who's a genius. And, you know, and that's something I can afford to do and get the book out there and get the story out there. And it's actually making money. So, yay.
So real quick, what is The Pineys about?
The Pineys is about a family of hunters that hunt the kin of the Jersey Devil, is the sort of pitch. And basically, in the story, Mother Leeds, the mother of the Jersey Devil, was a witch. And this is one of the versions of the Jersey Devil tale, that she was a witch. But my version, she opened up the portals of hell in the 1730s and flooded the Pine Barrens with devils, like hundreds of them. But in the neighboring village of Abe's Hat, New Jersey, the villagers formed a secret hunting society to hunt down the devils and send them back to hell. And their ancestors continue the hunt to this day.
Oh, that's awesome.
So for 288 years, the Galloways have lived in the Pines, and they have hunted devils to protect the locals from evil and themselves. And they've developed all various ways to do it, and it's kind of what they do as a family. Although they all have their own professions, they all have jobs and whatnot, but on the weekends, they hunt devils.
Do you,
with the possible exception of one of the characters in the book.
Do you look for your personal life as inspiration? Like, do you find characters that you've grown up with that you've inputted into the story in The Pineys?
The inspiration I found in The Pineys was what I wanted to create was something that was very South Jersey. And South Jersey to me was my family, because I come from a very large extended family. My dad was one of eight, and my grandmother on my mother's side was one of 12. And so I have this insanely large extended family with many cousins and aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
Or cousins who were so much older than me, I called aunts or uncles. And so that's what I put in the Pineys. Like, the Galloways, just, they have these family events, and there's, it's just chaos. And there's like 200 people there, and like, you know most of them, but like, there's just so many kids, you don't even know whose kids are who, and you know, it's just chaos.
Oh yeah, I mean,
and,
as a Hispanic person, you know, with I think the I was getting some pretty bad lad. I was saying, like, as a Hispanic Catholic down here in South Texas, I can feel that large familyness.
Right, oh. Yeah, you know, the potlucks and the just too many kids, and the teenagers are doing what teenagers always do, and you know, the adults are trying to keep a lid on everything, and you know, meanwhile all this craziness is going on, and there's this long history of the family and who's related to who, and everybody's in everybody's business. So that's part of what I wanted to capture in the Pineys. So that's sort of the background. And, you know, everybody kind of knows everybody else, and they have this such a long history that, you know, there's no doubt that they're always going to pull together, but there's always a lot of bickering between them because they know each other so well.
Sure, sure. Would you ever go back to script writing and to do something horror-like to showcase South Jersey and to showcase cryptids like the Jersey Devil?
Sure. I mean, I'm a writer, so as a writer mercenary, I'll work for anybody who pays me. you know, but unfortunately, that is always a dicey proposition, whether you're writing screenplays or you're just freelance writing. You know, until you're a big enough name that people are just going to drop thousands of dollars on you.
Right.
You just exist in the ethosphere of writing until somebody throws money at you. So right now I have a great client. He's an actor, and he does a online sitcom called Roommates, and I write that for him. And we got some other movie projects I'm writing for him, and it's mostly opportunities for him to act as the main character, and him to get to do, you know, he wants to do comedy here, and he wants to do drama there, and he wants to do mystery here. So that's the stuff I'm writing, like, on the side. You know, writing like a project for the Jersey Devil,
mm-hmm.
The question is, who would produce it?
Yeah.
And I was contacted by a production company that was attempting to do a Jersey Devil movie, but it was an absolute disaster from beginning to end.
Oh, man.
I want to say, first and foremost, I was never officially involved with the project. I was consulted, but I was never officially involved. And what turned out later was the screenplay they needed to fix had actually been stolen from another guy.
What?
So it was a terrible screenplay. Huh?
Oh, that was that's horrible.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's the movie industry. It's, you know, even when they have millions of dollars, it's still horrible. It's just, I always describe movies as, it's a giant pile of money that everybody grabs until it's gone, and then the movie has to be finished. So, you know, there are a few guys who know how to produce, and they know how to dole out that money properly and make a movie, and a lot of them just don't know what they're doing. And they want to get into it because they want to meet hot girls and be famous and make millions of dollars, but they don't know anything beyond that.
Right.
And when you try to tell them, hey, you know, this isn't how you make a good movie, people will hate this. They just go, you don't know what you're talking about. Just take your money and shut up. So it's, you know, I would love to do a Jersey Devil movie. Would it get done correctly? I don't know. They haven't done a correct one yet, in my view. I mean, they've done a few Jersey Devil movies. I don't think they've done very well. They don't look very good. So it's really tough to do something good. in especially in the movie realm. You know, a full-length movie costs a lot of money, and you know, even if you have the money, then you got to get the right talent, you got to get the right script, and that's the one thing they always skimp on, because you're always looking to cut cost on a movie. We got to cut cost. Okay, we don't have a screenplay. That's okay. I've got an intern. He'll just write it. Let's move forward. You know, that's the way they make movies, unfortunately. Ah, we got a hot chick, and we got this handsome dude, and I got this guy who was in a movie before 20 years ago. Ah, we can make a movie here. And then they have a terrible movie. And then, oh, well, but they can still make money on it, but it's still a terrible movie. Right. So, I mean, if you go to any of the horror cons, you'll see terrible movie after terrible movie. I mean, they're, you know, they're all horror, and they're all the same damn movie. Oh, it's a monster. Oh, it's killing people. Oh, no. Oh, here's a hot chick. Oh, God, it killed her. Here's another hot chick. Oh, God, I think it killed her, too. Ah, run. Ah, wait a minute. I figured out how to kill it. Ah, it's dead. Or is it?
And then it becomes a classic.
Right. It's a classic. Why is it a classic? Like these movies from the 80s. Oh, it's a classic. No, it wasn't a classic when it came out. I was there. you know, it's a classic because it's old and it's nostalgic and maybe it had some music in it. And maybe 40 years ago, it wasn't that expensive to get a punk rock group to do the soundtrack for your movie. I mean, there are some cool things you could do to make the movie pretty fun. But again, it's about the story. If you don't have a good story, forget it.
Yeah.
Or at least a good pitch. Like Killer Clowns from Outer Space, it's a pretty good pitch. It's a pretty stupid movie. But, you know, it endures. It endures. It has 80s music in it. It's just an incredibly insane concept. You know, but there were a million movies like that back in the 80s, but none of them were that crazy. Killer right. Clowns from Outer Space. People went, I'm not seeing that. But now it's considered a classic. They made a video game based on it.
We are approaching...
What I get...
We're approaching a point where movies now are either going to be this wonderful blockbuster of just cinema disaster... Or you'll get that one little like diamond in the rough that's like that just comes out to be a fantastic movie. And I remember horror movies in the '80s and '90s, and you are 100% correct.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you a movie that's well written, and you'll think I'm insane, but it is actually well written, and you can rent it on Prime. It's called Zombievers. And it's a stupid movie about zombie beavers. But every single character in that movie has their own voice. Every single one. Now, it's a typical stupid, like, 80s monster movie.
Right.
Where a bunch of hot girls go to a cabin, and then they're attacked by zombie beavers. And then the guys show up, and they try to help them, and then they're all attacked. And one by one, they're killed. And, you know, it's a stupid movie. But every single character has its own distinct voice, and it's very well written, surprisingly well written for what it is. So it can be done. The question is, will anybody bother? Because when you get two big stars and you've got millions of dollars in effects and you've got this and you've got an IP that everybody knows and you've got a pitch that, well, everybody will probably like, I don't know, naked aliens invade the United States. It's just, you know, they don't care. They don't care about the story. Yeah, it's going to sell. Who cares? I mean, Steven Seagal famously would have in his contract, like, all the things that would be in his movies. Like, he had to kick a guy in the head. He had to get a hot girl. He had to beat the villain. Like, all these, like, 10 different steps to a Steven Seagal movie. And, to some extent, it worked because Steven Seagal was were they good? I mean, I guess if you love Steven Seagal, you thought they were good, but people in this business, unfortunately, just most of them don't know what they're doing and they don't care as long as they make a big giant pile of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to end
for the time.
I wanted to end with the journey that you're on right now with the Pineys. Where do you want it to go? Do you want it to be going into like a graphic novel, or do you want it for it to be going into something more? Hopefully someone will pick it up for mainstream work. What's your ultimate goal for the Pineys?
My ultimate goal is to always be the J.K. Rowling of the Pineys. So J.K. Rowling got a fantastic deal for Harry Potter and was able to cast it, control it, and still controls it to this day. So that would be, if you approach me and you want to make the Pineys, you better give me that incredible deal. And if you can't, well, then you shouldn't waste your time, because I'm having a good time with it. I'm selling books, and that's all I need to do. So if I can sell, 10,000 books in a year, I'm good to go.
That's awesome.
I don't need a movie. I don't need a TV show. That's my goal. I had a dream that I sold 6 million books. So I sell 6 million books. I'm good to go. I don't need a movie. I don't need a comic book. I might still do them. I can do my own comics. I've done my own short little movies. So I'll probably do the movie myself if I can. But I've done little shorts where I'm Hemingway. So it's not out of the realm. I know what needs to be done. I just need a giant pile of money. I need to organize it. So, the Pineys, though, right now is a project where I go from town to town telling people about the origins of the Jersey Devil and other South Jersey folk tales, which I also incorporate into the books. And then the books themselves are a window into that universe of the supernatural, ghost stories, and local history. And I mainly keep it in South Jersey. So it's not North Jersey stuff necessarily, or Philly stuff, or any of that, although they get mentioned once in a while. It's all about South Jersey. And there's a ton of history here. I've just been doing research on pirates, and all the big name pirates stopped in South Jersey at one point or another.
Really?
And it was like the Wild West down here. Yeah. Blackbeard had a hideout on Petty Island in Pensauken, New Jersey, and him and Steve Bonnet would hang out, and they'd row across the river to Philadelphia and go spend their loot. They supposedly buried his treasure under a black walnut oak on Wood Street in Philadelphia, and up until 1875, there was a massive black walnut oak on Wood Street. They say a crazy Spaniard volunteered to guard the treasure in death and shot himself on the spot, and they shot his dog for good measure so he wouldn't be lonely in the afterlife, and buried the treasure there.
Man.
Yeah. So, and a quote from Ben Franklin, I'm paraphrasing, but he had a whole essay about this. He said, "People are searching for pirate treasure in Philadelphia to the ruin of their own families." So there was a ton of pirate treasure in the area. They say treasure is in Cape May, Burlington, Leeds Point, New Jersey. Captain Kidd's treasure's been rumored to be all over the place, on an island in the Manasquan River, right in Leeds Point. He supposedly had a mistress named Amanda, said, "Hold on to my treasure, I'm going back to England." He never came back. Did Amanda keep the treasure? Did she dig it up? Or we don't know. Black Bart, one of the most successful pirates who ever lived, had two ships, got cornered in Cape May by the British Navy, had to fight his way out. Both ships were laden with pirate gold because he had been on a tear up and down the East Coast. And one of the ships sank in the Delaware Bay, and the other one he got away on. So there's still a whole ship full of treasure at the bottom of the Delaware Bay somewhere. No one's ever found it.
Oh, wow. Yep. So it's not just
there's highway bandits.
I was about to say, it's not just people thinking about going down there to try to find just regular history. You're trying to find your wealth, you're trying to find your treasure over in, how, what is what 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 is that what does that tie into with how Jersey shapes people coming over there and trying to look for this treasure? Does that is that like kind of bothersome? Do you think, or are you just welcome people to trying to find nothing?
It doesn't really bother people because not a lot of people do it. There's not any good directions to the pirate treasure. They're all fables. What directions we have are all landmarks from 300 years ago, so good luck. You know, Captain Kidd, supposedly his treasure is under a grove of cedars. I mean, you're never going to find it, but
yeah,
you might. They could have been around 300 years ago. There are highway bandits that buried their treasure. Fagin and Fenton in Farmingdale, New Jersey, they operated out of that. And when Fenton was caught, he said, let me go, and I'll tell you where our treasure is. They said no. He tried to escape, and they shot him on the spot. Now, did he have a treasure? Maybe he was lying, but they never found it. Bloody John Bacon, who I write about in Book 6 of the Pineys, he was moderately successful as a pirate. He killed a bunch of people during the Long Beach Island Massacre. He fought in the last official battle of the American Revolution. He might have had treasure. Nobody knows where it's buried, though. So,
you're a 100% historian.
South Jersey town.
100% historian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the towns along the Jersey Shore may have originally been founded by pirates, because some of them were Lenni Lenape villages, and the pirates would come in and just buy them out or take them over. Say, no, it's our village now. Or they just start living there. And then years go by, and the piracy dies, and the 1800s roll around, and some guys come in and buy it, and then they get bought out in the 1900s by industrialists, and then you get some of these shore towns in South Jersey. There's still stories about pirates going into the 1800s, long after the Golden Age of Piracy, because it was kind of an insurance scam for shipping magnates, because they would ship stuff, and if the ship sank and they lost their cargo, a lot of times the cargo would wash up on the shores, and people from the town, local towns, would come out and steal it all, which was fair because, you know, it was like maritime law. But they wanted the insurance money and they wanted the goods back. So they would smear the locals as what they call wreckers. And they said, no, the ship didn't sink on its own. These people lured the ship in, and they're bad people, and we should get the cargo back, and we should get the insurance money. So that was a thing in the 1800s.
Oh, man. I wanted to end with one final question. What is your favorite thing about the Jersey Devil? Like, what is it? The research? Is it the history? Like, what's that one thing that keeps you doing what you're doing, the Pineys and all the research and all the history? What is it about the Jersey Devil that just makes you happy?
I just love the history. I mean, the history, as the history unfolds to me, I discover more and more about South Jersey. So, for instance, one of the tales I read about was called The White Stag. And the tale of the White Stag goes something like, one stormy night in South Jersey, some Quakers were driving their horse and buggy toward a covered bridge in a storm. And before they got to the bridge, a white stag reared up and stopped the horse and buggy. And it turned out the bridge was out, and they would all been killed had they tried to go across the bridge, and the white stag saved them. And ever since, the white stag has been a symbol of good travel in South Jersey.
Oh, wow.
We have a road in South Jersey called the White Horse Pike. It's Route 30. It's one of the oldest roads in South Jersey, if not the oldest. It's called the White Horse Pike. I think it was named the White Horse Pike because the white horse is a white stag.
That's awesome. That's so amazing. I am having such a fun time. I can talk to you about this and all the history about New Jersey for an entire day. again, Mr. Tony DiGirolamo, I truly, truly am so grateful that you reached out and wanted to be a part of the show and come on and talk about the Jersey Devil. Please, right now, feel free to shout out all your socials. I will when this airs, I'll put all of your information on there. I'll put the website where all your book signings are in. Please, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you. You can find my books at thepineys.com and, of course, on Amazon. If you just search for The Pineys or search my name, Tony DiGirolamo, you can find me on Twitter, Truth, all everything. Every social media I think I'm on, I usually use my name. You can find my webcomics at thewebcomicfactory.com if you want to read some of my webcomics. And if you want to read the first webcomic I did, it's called Superfat at superfat.com. You can find my comics all over the place in South Jersey and online. I did, of course, a comic called The Jersey Devil back in the 90s for 12 issues, and I still have copies if you're in the South Jersey area and want to get them from me. I have other comics I've done over the years. I've worked for The Simpsons Comics. I work for Kenzer & Company. I have a game called Complete Mafia for D20. You can check that out. That's also on Amazon. You just do a search for my name and a bunch of stuff will come up. You can check out my YouTube, BitChute, Rumble, and Odyssey channels if you want to see my wacky videos and my angry opinions on film and various other things. So, and my dog, Joan, will be in the video, so you can see her. And I do a live stream every Sunday where we do it live. So, I'm always doing something on the internet.
Again, thank you so much for coming out. And real quick, I wanted to ask, you said you did something for D20. Are you a Dungeons & Dragons player? Are you a tabletop RPG player?
I am one of the original guys. I mean, I started gaming in like 77 in middle school. And I played first edition, second edition, third edition. Didn't really get into fourth edition. By that time, I didn't really. All my players are all, older with families and stuff. Nobody has any time to play anymore. I worked for Kenzer & Company. They did Hackmaster, the RPG.
Yes.
Which was, they licensed first and second edition. And I rewrote the monsters for the Hacklopedia of Beast. So it's basically the Dungeons & Dragons first and second edition through the eyes of a comic called Knights of the Dinner Table, if you've ever read that. It's all about gamers. And I had an official Hackmaster's DM card, so I was officially licensed in Hackmaster. And I did Complete Mafia for D20, which was a third edition OGL licensed book where... it's just mafia stuff for Dungeons & Dragons and covers the history of the mafia from 1282 to the modern day.
Oh, wow.
So I also did a module for Hackmaster called Slaughterhouse Indigo. So you can check that out. It's got the classic, old TSR look to it.
Yes.
Part of the aesthetic of Hackmaster was that old school D&D.
Yeah, I am I'm a product of second edition. I started in the mid 90s, and my dream right now, one of these days I'll get good enough to write an adventure path for Paizo, for Pathfinder and all the wonderful stuff. I can talk about Dungeons & Dragons and nerd stuff again for another day. So, man, this is going to be a fantastic little thing we're doing in the future. Man, this is awesome. Again, thank you so much for being a guest. I truly do appreciate it. I was so happy when you reached out. One of those things that I thought that I would never have somebody who honestly wanted to reach out and talk about one of the cryptids I did a story on. So this is fantastic. Again, thank you so much, Tony. I truly do appreciate it. Thank you guys for listening. The show will be out in a couple of days. We're gonna stop right here, and then I'm gonna do some edits and posts, and then it'll be out in the public. Thank you so much, guys.
Later. Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for having me on the show.
And now for your listening pleasure, Joel, I am the Loch Ness Monster.
This life in darkness, brief glimpses of the sun. I was once a mighty beast, ruler of the land and of the sea. Now hiding here below, when can I come up to breathe? Come up to breathe. Is this what they call living? Here below the surface, maybe I deserve it. Inside, if I sink or I swim, does it matter at all? Or will they think when they finally see I'm not everything that they hoped I would be? I'll take my chances, I'm rising to the light, rising to the light.